Morning, everybody. I'd like to introduce our speaker this morning, Andrea Martin, who's been a member of this community for many, many years, and she's going to be talking six times, once a month, about the new book that she has just edited, The Light That Shines Through Infinity, Zen and the Energy of Life by Dainin Katagiri. Dainin Katagiri was the founding teacher here. He ordained me and is responsible for a lot of wonderful teaching over the years, which is why we're all here. And here today, we're also, it's also my pleasure to see Tomoe Katagiri. Tomoe Katagiri moved here in we bought this place in 1975, but we had to renovate the upstairs. As soon as we had it renovated, Tomoe and Katagiri Roshi moved upstairs, and I moved into the neighborhood. And when I moved into the neighborhood, my wife said, "I'm tired of moving around. Let's stay here for a while." That was in 1975. Tomoe has been was chief sewing teacher for all the raksus and robes that we've sewn here in the upper Midwest for 40 years. And she retired, about 2 years ago now? Is that right, Tomoe? So we're just delighted to have her here, and we're delighted. This is his fourth book, and it's the best one. It's the best one. Well, the last one's always the best, anyway. But it is the best one. What?
No, it's not the last.
Oh, it's not the last. Oh, Bonnie's working on one. Okay. All right. So we're just very happy that Andrea, who has been here many years, and this is the second book that Andrea's done, has put so much kind attention and warmth into elucidating some very wonderful teaching.
Thank you, Tim. I want to acknowledge Tomoe-san also. Thank you so much for coming, Tomoe. I really think of Tomoe as a co-founder of the Zen Center. And the mother of Zen Center, and I really thank you for coming today. And thank you all for coming and giving me a chance to talk about this work that I've been doing and about this book by our founder. Katagiri Roshi died 27 years ago, so now for most of you he's a mythological figure. I hope through his books you can get some sense of his warm heart and his deep, profound wisdom, because he really had a wonderful way of teaching and presenting Buddhism that many, many people loved him for. Today I'm going to talk a little bit about how I arrived at spiritual energy and taking refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha as my main theme for the book. And I want to give you just a quick overview of some of the philosophical foundations. I know philosophy is a word that, well, maybe you embrace it or maybe you want to run away when you hear it. But anyway, I'm going to inflict a little bit on you because I think it's important. And then I'm going to end with three of what I call Katagiri Roshi's mottos. They're kind of slogans. He had a lot of them that he'd sprinkle in his teaching, and there's three that I in particular want to talk about. So for the quote on today's program, I chose something from the very early pages of the first chapter of the book. And let me read it. Shakyamuni Buddha taught that a magnificent event is unfolding in every aspect of everyday life. Vivid living energy is constantly at work, creating and supporting your life. It is just like a fire that is eternal and boundless. Whoever you are, your life is very precious because the original energy of life is working in your life. So maybe it's kind of a surprise to hear Katagiri Roshi say this is what Buddha taught. Because usually we think of Buddha's teachings as sort of working around the Four Noble Truths about suffering and the fact that there's an Eightfold Noble Path to liberation or freedom from suffering. And that is, of course, an absolutely essential teaching of Buddhism. But I think it's just one side of the Buddhist message and the side that looks at life from our human point of view. Kadagiri Roshi loved to show us our life from the other side, from the Buddha point of view. He's always telling us that no matter who we are or what we think of ourselves, our lives are important and we're part of something bigger than ourselves. So spiritual energy wasn't actually my first idea for the book. My first idea was to do something on spiritual light because it was something that I had always maybe been a little confused about when Kadagiri Roshi was talking in the 80s. I was always trying to figure out what was it. Was it a metaphor? Was it something real? I had a hard time with it. At one point, I even went to the Encyclopedia Britannica and looked up light, trying to find some way that I could, in my mind, make a connection to what he was talking about. Anyway, there was one particular talk that started me imagining this book. I had found it when I worked on Each Moment is the Universe, the previous book. I wanted to use it there, but I couldn't get it to fit in. It just didn't work, so I had to abandon it at that point. It was a commentary on a gatha, which is a short verse, that was associated with the ritual of offering incense. And the second line of the verse was what really stuck in my mind. It was, "Radiant light of the Buddhas emits throughout the Dharma world." And I really loved that line, and in a sense, that line became the book. I was kind of amazed when I realized that the title that Shambhala eventually gave to the book, The Light That Shines Through Infinity, is expressing something kind of similar to Radiant Light of the Buddhas Emits Throughout the Dharma World. And I just said, whoa, coincidence. I did find a lot of good material on light, and it's in the book, but I couldn't find enough to make a whole book, so I was kind of stuck. And then I was watching a science show on TV, I'm not sure what channel it was on, and I heard them say, light is a way of transmitting energy through space. And it was one of those aha moments for me, because I realized that I could take light and expand it into energy and find and look for a lot more material that way. And around that time, too, I recalled a conversation I had had with Kadagiri Roshi at an informal tea gathering here called a chosan. And those were occasional events where all whatever students wanted to come would come here, and Kadagiri Roshi would be here, and we'd all sit around and drink tea together. And it was a time when students could just bring up whatever was on their mind or whatever they wanted to hear him talk about. And I had come with a question. I had never been to a chosan before, and as far as I can remember, I never went to another one. But I came to that one because I had a question that I wanted to ask. And that night, Tomoe-san was also there. So I have a witness or someone who can correct me if I don't remember this story quite exactly correctly. But my question came out of a situation in my family life. My father-in-law was living with my family. I was taking care of him a lot. He had colon cancer, and his doctor had kind of given us the word that maybe it was time to let him go. And that seemed like such a difficult thing to get my head around. So that's what I came to the Chosan with. I asked, how do you think about a question? How do you think about that suggestion? And I don't really know what I expected to get, probably something on Buddhist ethics. But Katagiri Roshi immediately started talking about life energy. At that time, he started talking about life energy, and Tomoy participated, and she said that my father-in-law had three life energies. And essentially what I understood was that his life was working with the whole universe's life, and when his three energies were used up, he would just simply die. At that time, I really didn't know anything about Asian energy philosophy. And so not much of what they were saying really made any sense to me. But I somehow pulled something together and I said, so I should just make my best effort to take care of them and let the universe take care of the rest. And Katagiri nodded. Well, after that, it turned out we never really did have to make any major decisions about my father-in-law. Things just seemed to happen very naturally, and he died very quietly and peacefully in our home with all of us there. But the seed of the three energies was planted in my mind, and it sprouted later when I was auditioning talks for this book. I did listen to a lot of talks that I chose from when I decided what to include in the book. And I started noticing times when Katagiri Roshi said things that connected energy to Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. And that was really, really interesting to me. And that's what I decided I really wanted to work with in pulling the book together. After working on the book, I decided to do a little internet research to find out about these three energies. And I'm not an expert, so if anyone here is, I'm sorry. I'm just going to relate what I found on the internet that was interesting to me, because I think it's relevant to the discussion of energy. So the three energies are part of traditional Chinese medicine and are related to Taoist philosophy. Tao is the original energy of life, or the undifferentiated energy that underlies creation. In Chinese medicine, there are three life energies in the body, Jing, Qi, and Shen. And they are known as the three jewels, or the three treasures. Hey. Jing is essence energy. It's a set amount of original energy given to a person at conception. Jing enters our tissues and becomes the root of our body. And part of the reason I'm mentioning it is in the very first paragraph of the book. It says, Life doesn't come into existence without life force. Life force is given to you, so when you become conscious of your life force, of your life force is already there. It is your life right here, right now. You cannot build up your life force after your birth, but life is something you can build up. So this life force you cannot build up, in my mind, pretty good relationship to a certain amount of original energy given to a person at conception. And in reading, I discovered there is some, in Taoist philosophy, or there is some way you can actually build it up, but it's very, very difficult and not something the average person would undertake. Qi is vitality energy, and it's cosmic energy associated with the air or breath. It animates life, furnishes functional power for movement and change, and links us to the universe as a whole. The third one, Shen, is spirit or mind energy. It's developed when Jing and Qi are in balance. It's said that when our Shen is strong, we have peace of mind and glow with spiritual light. Qi energy is the energy most familiar to us now through all kinds of Eastern arts of medicine and martial arts and health. It's almost like something everybody knows now. And it can be enhanced after we're born. When Buddhism arrived in China and gradually merged with Taoism to form Zen, the three jewels became associated with the Buddhist triple treasure of Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. I'm not claiming that there's an exact correspondence between the three. I think it would be really interesting to give a really careful look at that, because I can see a lot of similarities between each set of triple treasures. In Buddhism, Buddha is often understood as a historical person. Dharma is his teaching, and Sangha is the community of people who practice that teaching. But the Buddhist triple treasure can be understood on a lot of different levels. From the point of view of this book, I think we can think of Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha as three aspects of the original energy of life. So when you take refuge in Buddhism's triple treasure, you're taking refuge in energy which is alive in your own life. Next, I do want to spend a little time on the philosophical foundations of Katagiri Roshi's teaching, because he refers to it or alludes to it so often in his teaching that you need something to kind of anchor yourself to. And another warning, I have an editorial mind, and I'm always trying to simplify things so that I can kind of get a handle on them. So it's a little dangerous in philosophy, because Buddhist philosophy is very complicated. So this is kind of a travel at your own risk warning. I've had to, because I'm not a philosopher or really want to be, especially a philosopher, my mind doesn't go that way. I've kind of condensed it for my own purposes, and so that's where I'm coming from. One important thing about Buddhist philosophy is that it's not dogma. It's not something we're supposed to believe. It's more of a description of reality and how things work. And what we're supposed to do with it is make it real in our own lives. It's really meant to be an inspiration rather than a burden. So the Buddhism that arrived in China was Mahayana Buddhism. The Mahayana movement developed in India after Buddha's lifetime. And this is a little bit of a simplification, but there was a sense that Buddha's teaching was being used too much in the sense of developing an arhat as an individual enlightened person who became enlightened and therefore was free. And it was a very narrow approach that didn't invite a lot of people in. So there was an effort to expand Buddha's teaching. The idea of the compassionate bodhisattva was developed to balance the wisdom with compassion. And so philosophers took a deeper look at Buddha's teaching and gave it a bigger scope, and in doing that, or to do that, they developed a lot of new sutras that they presented as having been written by Buddha. which did cause a lot of controversy because you probably hadn't read them. One of those sutras which became important to us was the Avatamsaka Sutra, which is the Flower Ornament Sutra. And there's some interesting lore around this sutra. So the lore says that immediately after Buddha attained enlightenment, he expounded the complete sutra as an expression of the realization of the pure nature of reality. But the people who heard it were completely confused, and it made absolutely no sense to them. So he started to think about his teaching differently. And what he chose to do was to use a formula like a physician diagnosing an illness, which is the Four Noble Truths, that there is suffering, there's freedom from suffering, there's a cure, there's a path, there's a cause, there's a path, you know. Didn't get that quite right, but pretty familiar. But the story goes that the original teaching didn't just go away, it was preserved in the Avatamsaka Sutra. So the Avatamsaka Sutra was one of the sutras that arrived in China and was translated there. And gradually, over many, many years, centuries actually, it developed into the Huayan school of Buddhism. And that school sees the universe as one dynamic, interconnected, interpenetrated totality in which everything is influencing everything else and being influenced by everything else. And that vision of one totality very much influenced Zen and Dogen. It came down to Katagiri Roshi through his Soto Zen training. And now it's coming to you. Katagiri Roshi also drew on other philosophies in his teaching, but I think the Huayan vision of the totality was his core philosophical basis. When he says, vivid living energy is constantly at work, creating and supporting your life, he's really speaking from the Huayan vision. Katagiri Roshi really wanted people to have enough understanding of the structure of Buddhist philosophy to see that it's really telling us something about our own lives. We live our own individual lives, but we're also connected to the whole of life. We're living in an integrated system, and we are in some way influenced by everything in it, but we're also influencing everything in it. So we should understand what's going on. When it comes to the study of philosophy, as I said, I'm not that interested in abstract thinking. I'm more of a practical person. But to edit Katagiri Roshi, I had to bite the bullet. I had to understand, at least in some functional way, the philosophy that he was talking about. Lucky for me. He wasn't really being abstract. He often said, I'm not talking about an idea, I'm talking about something real. So I looked at the philosophy as a description that was of something that was actually happening in my own life. And I related my own spiritual experiences to the structure of the philosophy so that I could kind of feel my way through the philosophy, through my own heart and my own experience of what I resonated to when I dealt with certain parts of the philosophy. Even so, I really had to fight my way through all those technical terms. There's so many technical terms, and they are so slippery. They're used in so many different ways, sometimes interchangeably, sometimes with a fine distinction, sometimes with capital letters, sometimes not. they still feel pretty slippery to me, but I've kind of made peace with it. So here's how I think about it. I think of it as a creation story without a creator. In this story, the universe is constantly being created and recreated by itself in a series of distinct moments. This happens so quickly that we aren't aware of it. It's kind of like a movie. Well, you know, a movie is a series of discrete still images, but when it's played, it becomes a movie that we perceive as something actually going on continuously. So Dogen claimed that there were 6,400,099,180 moments in every day. Katagiri Roshi said, I don't know where you got that number. The important thing was to realize there were a lot of them. But I was curious, and I really tried my best, which is just my best, not the best, to figure out where such a number could have come from. And I ended up going 6,000 years back to a Vedic system of measuring matter and time called the Paramanu. And I didn't ever actually run the numbers. I didn't look at how they measured certain discrete parts of time and try to see, oh, would that add up to 24 hours in a day? But if you're interested, Paramanu, it's a theory of atoms and particles. So it's very interesting when you look at Buddhism from a science point of view. Now, it isn't actually Buddhist, it's pre-Buddhist. So when we talk about the universe creating itself, universe is one of those multidimensional Buddhist words. Here it stands for the Yin understanding of the totality of existence, that is a dynamic process of shared identity, interdependence, and intercausality. That's the universe in the previous book, the title, Each Moment is the Universe. It's in this book in the word infinity. It's in Dharma world, in that line from the Gata that I liked so much, the light that shines throughout the Dharma world. And it's got other words. Sometimes people call it the Dharma Dhatu or the cosmos. So anyway, when a moment begins, the universe is in a vast state of emptiness, which contains all life and energy, but it has no form. Then the basic energy starts to move. In Each Moment is the Universe, Katagiri Roshi called it the pivot of nothingness. So at the pivot of nothingness, that energy arises as one whole being. There's nothing outside it. There's nothing left behind. It's the whole thing starts to arise. And it becomes the differentiated forms of everything in the human world. So it includes us. It's us. And then it happens according to a really complex and unknowable combination of causes and conditions that are operating in that particular moment. And after that, we all lose our individuality and go back to the emptiness. And then it starts all over again. But the you and me that come up are a little different because the causes and conditions in that moment were a little different. And that's change. So if you were interested in that, Each Moment is the Universe was really about it. It's the Buddhist teaching of impermanence. And you can read a lot about it if you read Each Moment is the Universe. Looking at the triple treasure in this creation story, I see Buddha as the original formless energy of emptiness, Dharma as that energy's creative phase when it's functioning according to causes and conditions, and Sangha as that energy's embodied phase. So here we are as a Sangha embodying Buddha right now. So this is the story of our life, but our human minds impose a barrier on our ability to see it and realize that it's happening. So we have to train our minds to go below the surface and see the big picture. Katagiri is always giving us suggestions on how to do that. How to train our minds to tune into that energy because it's within us already. And when we do touch it, we realize that life is sublime and we can enjoy just being alive. Katagiri had lots of pithy slogans or mottos to remind us how to get unstuck from the surface of life. And I've been carrying them around in my head ever since. Three in particular are: relax your frontal lobe, let the flower of your life force bloom, and walk together hand in hand. Keeping these in my mind helps me to flip a switch when I'm living too much on the surface, and it reminds me to go deeper. So the first motto is relax your frontal lobe. In our brains, the frontal lobe is brain activity that's building up our personality. It helps us with thinking, planning, and decision making, and it's a good storyteller. Always telling us a story about who we are and what our life is all about. It helps us to face all kinds of threats, real and imagined, but it's only telling us part of our story. So relax your frontal lobe means to let go of your story and your mental activity long enough to get a taste of the deeper part of your life. You can actually feel a release in the feel of my forehead, in my head when I do that, and my body feels heavier in a really pleasant way. So I think that if you can feel that heaviness, that sinking down, you rest there. Just feel like you're someplace you can trust. You feel safe. And for me, that's taking refuge in Buddha, or the root of my life. This is a mind training skill that we use all the time in Zazen, but it's also handy in everyday life. If you can find the connection to something deeper in your life, you can bring it up into your surface of your life, your everyday life, and use it for presence of mind. Katagiri Roshi said that to be a wise and compassionate person, you had to be master of yourself in whatever situation you may be. So let your mind relax and let yourself go deeper. Get in touch with the more profound aspects of your life. And then bring them back to benefit yourself and everyone around you. The second motto is, let the flower of your life force bloom. This reminds me to be present with whatever activity I'm doing and doing it in a wholehearted way, with a spirit of practice. The big sense of the word practice is to receive and use the creative Dharma energy that's arising in us all the time from emptiness and practice with it, with our own body and mind. But it also, when we practice, we're practicing with the whole universe. So our activity is within the whole universe. We don't usually see that dynamic activity within ourselves because it's covered up by our human consciousness. But when you practice relaxing your frontal lobe, sometimes you do get a taste of it. Blooming is opening your awareness up to the whole world that is arising in you right now and actually experiencing it with your body and mind. In general, we don't talk much about the energy aspects of Zazen, and I think in a way that's to protect us from going astray a little bit and focusing too much on that, and becoming kind of self-centered about it, and not being good bodhisattvas. But that doesn't mean that it doesn't happen, and I think is actually an enjoyable aspect of zazen. So if you do feel some energy arising within your body or mind when you're practicing zazen, just relax and enjoy it. Don't get analytical about it. Don't engage with it. Just let it come and go. Just let your mind stop. Just relax. Go back to breathing over and over and over again. And let whatever that is just show you something about your life. You can do this in any aspect of everyday life, washing the dishes or moving around your office. I can imagine Katagiri Roshi's practice of walking wherever he was. He walked in a calm and stable way. He always seemed aware of what was going on within himself and in the space around him in a very respectful way. He really had a sense of transmitting peace to the space and the people in it that were around him. One time I was his attendant on a trip to Nebraska for an event around a Zen center there. We were walking on a sidewalk, and he was wearing his monk's attire. He had his shiny shaved head. And there were a group of people on the other side of the street who started jeering at him and heckling him and insulting him in a really aggressive and boisterous way. I was really shocked because I had never seen him treated in any way other than a respectful manner. And it felt really dangerous, and I felt scared in the situation. But Katagiri Roshi just kept walking in his same calm, smooth way. And his peace transferred to me. I picked up on it and I relaxed and was able to carry on with the whole situation. The third motto is walk together hand in hand. And this is actually my favorite one. For me, this one has the spirit of Sangha and of being with all sentient beings. The term all sentient beings is another tricky one. It isn't always used the same way in Buddhism. But for Katagiri Roshi, it means everything that exists in the human world of phenomena. He uses the word phenomena. The world of phenomena, that's this world where things have their own identities and, you know, we're individual people. Is the embodiment of Buddha energy. In other words, everything is alive with Buddha energy. I really like the words walking and hand in hand in this one. Walking is a rhythmic activity where one foot is in front and the other one is behind, and then they change places. So walking in Buddhism can be a metaphor for the rhythmic movement of energy between form and emptiness. So saying that we are walking together reminds me that my life is interconnected with all of your lives, and we are traveling together between form and emptiness. Holding hands is a really spectacular image. I've only done a little Tai Chi now, but I became aware of the energy in my hands almost immediately. Reiki uses, healers use their hands to transmit spiritual energy. In Zazen, we put our palms together to greet each other as expressing our oneness with each other. When we sit down to do Zazen, we put our hands palms up on our knees before we start, and I think we're drawing in energy through our hands. Then we put them in a cosmic mudra to form the whole universe, and we put it just below our navel, which is the Dantian energy center in our body. And then there's the 1,000 compassionate hands and eyes of Avalokiteshvara. Holding hands with someone is such a sweet thing to do. A parent or grandparent or and child or two people drawn to each other, we naturally, instinctively hold hands. I think we take refuge in each other by holding hands, offering each other our energy to each other, and expressing trust and refuge in each other. I think you can also have this relationship with the material world. Katagiri Roshi had a way of handling objects that was tender and kind. I think when he touched things, he recognized them as embodied Buddha energy and offered his respect to them. His frequent example of how to do this was to remember that when we used toilet paper, the lowliest thing that he could think of, we should realize that we're using the life of the toilet paper and use it with respect. We should be aware of how toilet paper supports our life. One day when my spirits were low, I learned about sharing communion with material things, kind of by accident. I was feeling low and I walked into my kitchen and I just sort of instinctively put my hand on my kitchen countertop, which was made of granite, and I felt like I just wanted to connect with something real. And it surprised me because when I did that, I really felt something come back to me, and it helped me to settle down. So I think you could say I took refuge in my kitchen countertop. Now when I'm down, I try to be mindful of the truth that everything around me is alive and sharing my life with me. Things are traveling along the same path as I am, and I now think of things more as my traveling companions. Finally, to close, I want to acknowledge how difficult human life is for all of us. There are many problems, and there's no easy fixes. Katagiri knew and respected the suffering of human life, but at the same time, he was always reminding us of the beauty of human life and helping us learn about the depth and significance of our own lives. I started working on this book at a point when I was heading into difficult times because of an illness of a family member. Working on this book has been my way of studying with Katagiri Roshi throughout that time. Editing was a refuge for me, and the teachings I worked on helped me to see my own life in a more positive way. I really hope that this book will help you with your own life story, and that your Zen practice will give you refuge, hope, and happiness. Well, that's what I wanted to say this morning. And I have a drink of water, and if you'd like to have anything you'd like to say or questions.
Andy, I just want to thank you for doing that. I'm really looking forward to this. Thank you. I know it's a lot of.
I feel very fortunate to have been able to do it, and I feel like I was entrusted with something that it was my honor to. You know, I wish that it could be better. I did the best I could, but I think it's. I hope it's good enough.
Remind people that there's a copy on reserve on the table downstairs in the library.
Oh, excellent.
And also I wanted to mention one saying that I heard with categories, I don't know, that he used was nothing extra.
That sounds nice. Yeah.
That's something I need to help.
Keep it simple.
Yes. So why do you think energy phrased that way, that could be called emptiness and things like that, has been so neglected in Western Buddhism?
In Western Buddhism?
Well, I don't know.
I think that one thing, I think, is that the Four Noble Truths is such a magnificent teaching, and that our Western society has so much suffering and so much confusion and so needs to hear the message of the Four Noble Truths that it's become our dominant teaching in Buddhism. And also, I think that philosophers in the past have observed that energy can be a tricky thing. You know, you have to be really careful with your energy. You have to keep it in balance. You have to not use it for your own personal gain, but to have a spirit of generosity with your energy. There's times in history where people have used their energy to become, celebrities, to do tricks, things like that. So I think there's always a little caution in doing it. And also, I think if you do start working with your own energy, you need to have somebody to talk to about it. You don't want to just go off, because it can be powerful stuff. Okay.
In our retreat yesterday, Wanda talked a lot about harmonizing energy. Mm-hmm. I found that a very useful idea to think about. As you're saying, that energy can go off in strange places, but if you think about harmonizing the energy, that feels more comfortable.
Good, yes. That's very nice. That's very, very important. I think in that that Shen, they were talking about how it's putting two energies together, and that's when that you have your spiritual light, that you really feel the beauty of your own life.
I think also that in the Western tradition it's too easy to confuse the energy as being really your own, and the essence of it from the Eastern point of view is that it's not your energy ultimately. I mean, you have experience of it, you have use of it for a time being, but you didn't create it.
That's beautiful. That's beautiful, right?
So,
you're a custodian of it while you're enjoying it.
That's not the typical Western.
Right.
It's hard to get across.
That's right. I mean, we think, oh, it's my energy. Oh, goody. I get to do something with this now. Yeah, I'm special because I got this energy. Woo, yay me. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Thank you. I love that.
Hey, Andrea.
Yeah.
I am studying and facilitating a study group with Taoism. And one of the teachings that I came across was, I can't remember who said it, but they said, one of the translators of the Tao said that, that our primary responsibility as a human being is to harmonize these two energies that you exist.
Oh, wow. Gosh.
And he used the name that you used, she and the other one. But I was not familiar enough with it to, really be able to understand it. So you helped me to understand it.
Yay.
So thank you.
How would you relate what you've been calling energy to the category of compassion?
I feel that when you experience your energy and you realize that it's not your energy, like you were saying, that this is the universe's energy coming up in you, you realize something sublime, but you realize that this isn't just about you, it's about everything with you. And there's just this natural, like when I talk about touching my countertop and feeling something there, that feeling of being together with something is kind of like love. And it just comes out as wanting to take care of things. Like, I want to take care of my kitchen countertop. I want it to be well and happy. You know, I love my car. I want my car to be happy. You know, just, that's all I've got. Lee?
Between the human beings and the planet, the time period where she teaches and the two put in this book anything about animal sentience and other animals you talk about?
There's nothing about animals in the book. And when we talk, when he talks about sentient beings, he isn't talking about sentience in the sense of consciousness. And it is in the book, and it's a little hard for me to still to get my head around it. But all sentient beings are the aliveness of the universe right now. And it includes animals, but it also includes inanimate things. And beyond that, even conceptual things like emotions or feelings or ideas. It's just everything that manifests itself in a distinctive way.
The first energy, will you tell me the name again? The first...
Jing.
What you said reminds me, it seems attached to karma. Is it at all? That's because you were saying that that's what...
It's given to you? I don't know about that. I think karma works more in the interdependent co-origination than in that exactly, but I don't know. I kind of over my head on that one. I don't know. It's a good question, though. Yeah, interesting. Okay, I think we'll just stop for now. I'll be back next month, and the first part of the book is what I'll be talking about. And it's got some big topics in it. I'm a little scared. Self, time and space, and light. So get ready. You don't have to read the book. It's not required reading. I'm just going to try to talk to you about it from my own point of view. And one thing I want to point you to is that Shambhala Publications, on their website, has put up on their website the first part of the book, my editor's preface that I wrote, and also the first chapter. Not the whole first part, but the first chapter. And if you go to Shambhala.com and search on Katagiri, see this cover there, click on that, get into the page for that. There's a little icon kind of on the lower part of it that says browse inside. If you just click on that, ta-da, you'll get the first, the preface and the first chapter. So if you want to read that before my next talk, go for it.